Hello, my name is Paul Warmington. I'm a professor in education at the University of Warwick, and I research quite widely around education, issues of equalities, and social justice. And one of the areas in which I've done quite a lot of research is the history of Black education and social movements in the UK, which is what I'm going to talk about today. One of my key areas of interest is in the emergence of Black communities in Britain in the years after World War II, the 1960s, the 1970s, and the 1980s. I'm interested in the way those communities arrived in Britain and the way they became embedded as part of British society. And I would say in those decades, the 60s, 70s, 80s in particular, schooling was one of the places in which what it meant to be Black and British was really fought out. One of the really interesting things about being an academic, looking at historical sources, is just the sheer range of sources that you can use. Now, a lot of those are documentary sources, so they might include policy documents and national government documents, or they might be also policy documents that were kind of issued at a local level in Liverpool or in Manchester or in Leeds. Various local reports that might be produced either by parents groups or by schools or by community workers and so forth are what we refer to as grey literature. So grey literature in research is where you have reports or little documents that weren't necessarily formally published by the government or by a school, but which you can find if you go around and find the right archive or speak to the right person. They'll sometimes say, oh, I've got a report that, you know, that we issued back in 1975. I don't know if you've ever seen it. So you have, as I said, policy documents, local reports. Also, something that we've benefited from a lot in the last few years in the UK is the emergence of some very, very important Black archives. So the different sources that I've talked about using include a lot of documentary sources. Now, documentary sources themselves actually cover a very, very wide range of material. They might be books, they might be newspapers, they might be campaigning materials from the past, and they might be posters or photographs or pieces of film and video. All of those are sources that we can use from the archives. Now, one that I'm going to talk about now, you can see, has the heading Black Children Dump. It's a poster, and it's a poster advertising what was one of the landmark texts in campaigns around race and education in the UK. The text I'm referring to was a short book written by Bernard Cord, who was an educator and social worker originally from Grenada in the Caribbean. And in 1971, Bernard Cord published a short book called How the West Indian Child is Made Educationally Subnormal in the British School System. And the poster here is actually advertising copies of that book, which actually was central to raising consciousness in Black communities about some of the things that were happening to Black children in British schools. And it was widely used in campaigns. It was widely read by parents, Black teachers, you know, other teachers, you know, whether Black or white in schools, who were interested in acting against some of the racist practices that were then prevalent in parts of the British school system. So let's think about the title. The title of Cord's book was How the West Indian Child is Made Educationally Subnormal in the British School System. What he was referring to was the practice of removing Black children at disproportionate levels from mainstream schools and putting them into what were then called schools for the educationally subnormal, ESN schools. Now, since about 1963, some Black educators and community workers had noticed that there was something suspect about the numbers of Black Caribbean children who were being taken out of mainstream schools and put into what were then called ESN schools. But it wasn't until a conference at the end of the 60s that was run by the North London West Indian Association and one of its allied groups, the Caribbean Educators and Community Workers Association, CESWA. They had a conference, and John LaRose, who was one of the leading characters in educational campaigns in London at that time amongst Caribbean communities, John LaRose asked Bernard Cord to speak because he knew that Cord had been doing some research around the placing of Black children in ESN schools. And what they discovered as Cord spoke to parents, community workers, school teachers, and so forth, was that there were really concerning numbers of Black children who were being taken out of mainstream schools for very, very spurious reasons. So often these were to do with the perceived behavior of the children. They were thought to be somehow unruly or aggressive. This was a kind of labeling that was often attached to Black Caribbean children. Sometimes it was to do with really a very controversial practice, and it was controversial even then, which was IQ testing. IQ stands for intelligence quota. And in the 1960s in Britain, there was almost a cult. It became very, very fashionable to subject children to IQ testing. And it was a very, very controversial process. One, there were lots of questions about the whole concept of intelligence. What is intelligence? And how can you measure it anyway? And also, the kinds of tests that were used to measure IQ were extremely controversial because it was said that they had a high degree of cultural bias. So they would use words, they would use phrases that were unfamiliar to children who'd arrived just from the Caribbean or from the Indian subcontinent. And one issue that I draw attention to there is around language. And this was one of the things that also meant children were taken out of mainstream schools and placed in ESN schools. And how it happened was that where you had children from the Indian subcontinent, sometimes they would speak Urdu or Gujarati, Punjabi as their first languages. And that was often thought of as being undesirable in British schools. But when Caribbean children came, they spoke what we call Patois or Creole. And very often teachers just didn't even understand that as a language. They just thought these children couldn't speak proper English, you know? So you had this cult of IQ testing. You had misunderstandings about Caribbean language. You had the behavior of Black children often being seen as somehow, it was often misinterpreted. It was seen as undesirable. And again, this often was sort of bound up with very sort of prejudiced ideas about Black children's speech, about their behavior and so forth. And it meant that disproportionate numbers of Black Caribbean children were put into schools for the educationally subnormal. And once they were in those schools, effectively, they were taken right out of the mainstream system with all that it had to offer in terms of qualifications and future employment. Now, the second source is a photograph. It's a visual source, and visual sources, whether they're photographs or pieces of video or film, are really very, very important and very useful in historical and sociological research. Now, this photograph shows a march, a protest by parents and teachers in the late 60s, calling for better education policy and better funding and resourcing of schools in the Haringey area. Haringey was a very, very important site of campaigning around race and education in the late 60s and early 70s. And one of the things that actually prompted that campaigning was a quite scandalous incident that happened in around 1968, 1969. What was happening at that point in British schooling was that there was the introduction of comprehensive schooling. So it was a move away from what was called the tripartite system, where you had grammar schools at the top and then technical schools, and then the majority of schools that were secondary modern schools. And it was an attempt to actually create a kind of single school structure for state education in the UK, comprehensive schooling. And in Haringey, comprehensive schooling was being introduced. And again, many Black parents thought, this is great. We're kind of moving ahead. We have an innovative form of schooling. This is going to be really good for our children. But then a document was leaked that had been produced by Haringey's local council. And the document was actually quite frightening in terms of its content, because it showed that the local council was using the reorganization into comprehensive schools to actually achieve another purpose altogether, which was a racialized purpose, a racist purpose. One of the concerns when Black children began to enter schools was about numbers of Black children, and it was about the concentration of Black children in particular schools. So it was seen to be undesirable to have more than a certain number of Black children in any particular school. Now, what was found in the leaked document from Haringey Council was, it was two things really. One was that the council was actually planning to use comprehensive reorganization to redistribute Black children in Haringey's schools, and that their reason for doing that was tied up with a very damaging educational practice of the time, which was the reliance and your obsession in parts of the British school system with IQ testing, with trying to test children's general intelligence by often very, very poorly worked out, very, very questionable tests called intelligence quota tests, IQ tests. And certain people on Haringey Council had come to believe, through their reference to IQ testing figures, that Black Caribbean children were inherently less intelligent than white children. And the Haringey report actually said this. I've got a quote here from the Haringey Local Education Authority in 1968. And this was the one that was leaked. It was meant to remain secret. And it says, on a rough calculation, half of the immigrants will be West Indians, Caribbean children, at 7 of the 11 schools in the Haringey area. The significance of this being a general recognition that their IQs, Black IQs, work out below their English contemporaries. So this report was openly racist, to openly claim that Black people were less intelligent than white people. And thus, it said, educational standards will be lower in schools where Caribbean children or West Indian children form a large group. So what you had was the awful entangling of different kinds of prejudice. One was the idea that Black children were somehow less intelligent or less academically capable. And the other was the belief that you shouldn't have too many Black children in any one school. Now, this report was leaked and it was picked up by political activists in the Haringey area and by very important Black community groups such as the North London West Indian Association. And they campaigned strongly and stridently against using school reorganization to disperse Black pupils. And they also began to call into question this idea that schools could be relying on supposed assessment through IQ tests as a way to justify placing children in particular schools or taking children out of the mainstream school system. So one of the things that historical sources show to us, whether they're visual sources, whether they're textual sources, it can really help us to understand change and just how different forms of education and other aspects of society can be if we look at them over time. So there were things happening in British schools in the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s even, that we'd be very, very shocked by now. And yet, they happened and they had an effect on generations of school children, both Black and white. But the experiences of Black communities at the time when Black communities were becoming embedded in British society had a particular effect, I would say, on the whole understanding of race, racism, multiculturalism and so forth in British society. So with these documents, you see two things. You see, on the one hand, structural inequalities in education, but you also see that Black communities weren't passive, they weren't victims. What you see is the real energy to campaign and to change society and to change education for the better. And I've referred a few times here to particular groups such as the Caribbean Educators and Community Workers Association, the Black Parents and Black Students groups, people like Bernard Kaur, John LaRose, who were figures that we should know more about, in the same way that we like during Black History Month to talk about Rosa Parks from the USA, or we like to talk about Martin Luther King. We also should know much, much more about these pivotal figures in Black British history, because they're also figures in British history in general. And the final thing that I would say that these documents show us is that at the time they were being produced, something very, very important was happening. Because I would say, you know, in the 1960s, even up to the early 1970s, there probably was amongst some people in Britain, not all people, but amongst some people in Britain, there was the kind of idea, the kind of fantasy that one day these black people who come to work in Britain and to help rebuild Britain after the Second World War would somehow disappear, would not be there anymore. And once black children were born in Britain and entered those schools, what became apparent was that black communities were here to stay. They weren't immigrant communities, but they were permanent communities whose presence would soon be absolutely part of the British landscape.